Blog Talk Radio.
And the cost left my heart broken, so I had it closed for repair. Wandering in my desert, your oasis appears. You're like a long cool drink of water. I'm thirsty, that's clear when I taste you. I know you, I know you, I do. So can you see? I need to know. Do you remember? Does it feel like coming home?
Hello, everybody. It's Mark Ross, and I'd like to welcome you to another radio show, which we call the Men's Spiritual Hour. We're on about once a month, and, of course, we're broadcasting from Spiritual Connections Radio, which has a number of shows that run every week. And I'd like to welcome everybody to another great show. As you know, we come on once a month with the Men's Spiritual Hour to bring in a man to talk about his spiritual journey, his life experiences, and the different things that he's seen in his life, and how he's interacted with other people. And with that, we have a great guest that we're going to be bringing on in a few minutes. As always, I'd like to tell you that if you miss any part of this show, or if you want to find out more about upcoming shows or the other shows that air on Spiritual Connections Radio, you can go to our website, which is www.spiritualconnectionsradio.com. And with that, I'd like to introduce my co-host, Mike. Mike, are you there?
Hi, Mark. I'm here.
It's always great to have you on, Mike. I don't know about you. I've been traveling around quite a bit the last couple of weeks. I was originally down in Florida, then I went out to California, and I just got back from Ohio. So I've been kind of just making my rounds. Of course, between Ohio and now being back in Pennsylvania, I'm surrounded by nonstop snowstorms. I don't know. How's the weather out your way? I know you're out towards the eastern part of Pennsylvania, so you probably got some snow, too.
Oh, snow. Yes, definitely. Lots of cold ice, snow. Just wintertime hasn't arrived yet officially, but it has arrived officially.
Yeah. So before we get too far into it, why don't we go ahead and announce our website. So if anybody wants to find out more about my work, the link for my website is actually up on Spiritual Connections Radio at the top. It's for Mark A. Rawson. You can find me at Mark A. Rawson. That's rawson.com. And, Mike, why don't you go ahead and give out your website so people can find out about your work.
Sure. My website is www.mikesnydercc.com. And to spell that out, www.mikesnydercc.com. And you can find all of my healing music and information about the sessions I do with sound healing on there.
Yeah, for a lot of people who have listened to the show in the past, you know by a lot of the conversations going on that I've actually been on the table and experienced a lot of Mike's work, which has been really incredible. And I personally vouch for him. If you ever had a chance to work with him and his music, either in person or remotely, make sure to check out his stuff. And he's got a number of CDs that are very beautiful with the channel music that he creates that you can actually purchase off of his website. And I think at this point, I think I have all of them. So
I think...
You know, for anybody who has questions about our guest that's on this evening or links to his Facebook page, if you go to Spiritual Connections Radio and scroll all the way down to the Men's Show, we actually have a photograph, a bunch of information, including the links for Facebook and everything. So make sure as you listen to the show tonight that you go and check that out. And with that, Mike, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest tonight?
Sure. Thank you, Mark. Okay, tonight we have Shanti. And he is a Jnana Yogi. He is a teacher, an author, a philosopher, and a true mystic. Shanti was born in a small village near Banda in India and raised in a wealthy family. After graduating the University of Allahabad with honors, he renounced worldly life and became a seeker of truth. When he was living in a cave, he realized the truth of non-doing and since has been sharing this wisdom, igniting others to realize their true nature. He's also the director of Handia Baba Yogalaya in Allahabad, India, and the founder of Shanti Temple in Montrose, Pennsylvania. He's been dividing his time between India and America and has been lecturing and teaching workshops in the U.S. since 1980, and he's also the author of several books. Again, I do apologize if I did mispronounce anything in there, but I would like to say hello, Shanti. Are you there?
Yes, sir. I am here.
Okay. It's great to have you on the show tonight.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a great honor. I'd like to share with everybody how my path got led to Swami Ji, and that is when I was staying down in Florida. I was actually between the place I was staying and actually staying with my friend Krista. I got talking to her about different spiritual things. And, you know, we were sitting on the couch one night and she said, you know, I want to bring up some YouTube videos and show you somebody that I had a chance to study under at one point. And she brought up a number of Swamiji's videos on YouTube. And I had a chance to look at a number of his teachings and had a chance to hear him lecture through those YouTube videos. And I was just like, wow, this is somebody that I definitely want to reach out to. And, you know, I think for a lot of the people in the spiritual field, we feel that sometimes teachers are just not available. And I was like, well, this is, you know, this is some high-level guru. There's no way I'm ever going to get a chance to see some of his wisdom or contact him. And she goes, no, you can just reach out to him on Facebook. And I'm looking at her like, no, that can't be possible, you know. And so sure enough, I reached out, and I think within an hour, I actually had a response. And, you know, we had a chance to share some messages with each other. And through that process, I approached Swamiji and said, you know, I really would love to have you on the Men's Spiritual Hour to interview you about your life journey and some of the experiences. So that's what led us up to this evening. So it's always amazing, I think, as I do the different radio shows, that I'm so blessed to be able to come and contact people who have such great light and such great teachings. And I kind of got cut off in the beginning of the countdown, but I wanted to just say, Swamiji, at the end of the show, you'll actually get disconnected because that's what the show does. But I want to make sure that I say thank you and really let you know that it's a great honor to have you on the show this evening.
I am very grateful and honored with your this sweet opening for me, Mark.
I'm going to just start with some basic questions because I know there's a number of our listeners in the United States that aren't familiar with some of the terminology. So we'll start with something really basic. What exactly is a Swami?
Swami in general means a renunciate. And then it has many, many other meanings, like Swami means a master, Swami means a teacher, Swami means a spiritual seeker. But basically, in India, it means a monk, a renunciate.
And is that... is that a term that you come to as you go through your journey, or is there like a guru or teacher that you studied under who gives that to you as a title?
Generally, it is given by a teacher under whom you learn spiritual practices and this kind of wisdom.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a child, can you tell me your story as far as how did you get to where you are now? You know, how did you come to the teachings and how did you decide to follow this path versus one of service of, well, not that this isn't of service, but, you know, such as just taking a regular job of making clothing or something. How did you decide this path?
I would say I was exposed to this kind of lifestyle because of my parents. They were very spiritually dedicated, and my mother was a very, very large-hearted, saintly woman. And so the way I was raised, and I was exposed to a lot of other swamis and monks and other holy Hindu scriptures, somehow I decided in a very early age, when I was maybe 6 or 7 years old, that that kind of life would give me the greatest joy.
So with that, as far as the way it unfolded for you, did you basically study, like did you go to a place and study every day, or did you leave your parents and go live someplace for a number of years?
Yeah, I did that, but for many years I completed first my university education till BA, and after that I stayed and lived with my spiritual teacher, who was also a monk and a very, very sweet and evolved soul. And after that I stayed at Cape also to work on myself more in a focused manner.
What did you study at the university?
I had English literature and history and philosophy and Sanskrit.
So, you know, as your journey unfolded after the university, tell me, what did you decide to do after the university was finished?
I just started living with my teacher, because even before that I had gone a few times away from my town and college to explore that kind of spiritual monastic life. And when I started living with my teacher, then there was nothing else to do but to do yoga, meditation, and spiritual practices that I thought, or he advised me, to be most beneficial for me.
Mm-hmm. So what was the name of your teacher at that time?
The name of my teacher was Sri Swami Vishnu Deva Nand Saraswati.
And, you know, during the time that you were studying, what was that experience like?
It is quite hard to describe. It is like when you have some kind of deep passion, deep urge to find out something, explore something. That kind of energy was very much into my heart, and that kept me moving.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, during the time that you were studying with your teacher, tell me about some of the practices that you had to do.
I would get up around 4 in the morning, and then I don't now remember how I did everything, but then I will do a couple of hours yoga, hatha yoga, and a few hours of meditation and pranayam. Then I will join him for cooking purposes, and then after that I would take a little break and read some scriptures and take a little nap or rest. And then again meditating, and then in the evening I will go for a walk, and after coming from a walk I will again meditate as much as I could, and then I will retire. That was generally the schedule of the day.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, during the day you said one of the things that you did was yoga. What do you feel is the purpose of yoga? I know from people in the United States, they look at it as something you do almost like going to the gym and working out, but I think yoga means different things to different people in parts of the world.
I would say when I was growing up, besides keeping our body healthy, its main purpose was to keep our mind more flexible, controllable, are easy to control our senses, impulsive habits and patterns. So I still believe it has a lot of that kind of power in helping us to control our mind and our impulsive-compulsive habits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, one of the first things I ever heard of when I got introduced to yoga was that, to me, my feeling was is that yoga was something that would allow you to get ready for meditation.
Well, that is already understood because in India, without meditation, yoga during those days was not considered complete. The whole purpose of yoga was to be ready for meditation. So when automatically your body is healthy and your system, our nervous system is more pure and somehow open, then mind easily becomes thoughtless or becomes more ready to be focused on whatever you want to focus at. So that is the basic understanding.
Mm-hmm. What is the type of meditation that you were learning from your teacher back then, and has it changed compared to what type of meditation you do today?
Yes, my teacher during those days emphasized that I should be meditating between the eyebrows. I should imagine a shining star and I should just meditate between the eyebrows, and it continued for several years. But when I was living in my cave, somehow it got shifted to something else. And so I nowadays neither I do that kind of practice, but I still put my energy on breath awareness, how I breathe in and how I breathe out. That is my simple and easy way of keeping my mind peaceful and clear.
Mm. Do you feel that the breath is important during yoga?
Yes, very important. But our mind is very closely related to our breathing, so that I very much believe that way.
Mm-hmm. Do you? I think one of the interesting things is that, you know, I had really gotten introduced to yoga about a year ago. And when I first got introduced, I had actually three different instructors, and I was, you know, experiencing three different types of yoga. It wasn't until I took a yoga class when I was in Florida a couple months ago that I got introduced to a teacher called Tony, who teaches in the Tampa, Florida area. And Tony was the first yoga instructor that I actually worked with who was very much teaching about using the breath. And he had some very interesting sayings during that. And he basically said that unless you're breathing during each of your movements of yoga, then you're really just stretching and it's not even yoga. So I thought that was kind of funny that he would bring it up that way.
I would say my practice of breathing is not so much related to yogic practice. It is more when I am walking or I am driving, or I am not particularly engaged in doing anything, then my mind should go on breath awareness and how I breathe in O and breathe out M. Om stands for divine cosmic consciousness, and since I somehow practice that way, still I end up doing that way. I breathe in the sound of O and I breathe out the sound of M. So I breathe in O and breathe out M. So somehow breathing plus this spiritual devotional flavor both give me some kind of power and inspiration and joy.
Mm. So is that something you would do during yoga, or is that something you would do during meditation, or both?
I would not be doing that during yoga. Yoga I will do independently of it in a very sweet, normal, relaxed manner. And I will do it either in the time of meditation or while I am walking or while I am just sitting in a casual way.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would you say? You had said that when you finished the university, you went to stay and learn from a teacher. And you had done that for how long?
Now it will be difficult to say how long because I am still doing, so I don't know how to reply that.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the interesting things I was wondering is after you left the university, you went to go to learn under the teacher. And I'm wondering, what is the biggest lesson that you learned from that teacher?
I would say from my point of view, the biggest lesson that I learned from my teacher was just his example. I don't mm-hmm. think I have met any person in my entire life so childlike, so playful, so cheerful, so detached, and so self-fulfilled. So when someone is exposed to this kind of qualities, automatically one feels more and more inspired and empowered to pursue that kind of life. So that is what I would say his greatest impact in my life.
So I'm leading up to the point because I want to hear, and I have so many questions about what it was like when you went into the cave. But can you tell me what led up to the cave after you were with your teacher?
I was living with my teacher in a big town, and next to my ashram, there was a big bridge being built, so there was a lot of sound coming there. So I decided, and my teacher also approved of that idea, that it is not so much suitable because the noise comes 24 hours. And that led me to somehow seek another place, and I ended up settling in that cave that became most dear to my heart.
So before we get to talking about the cave, you had said that you were there near the ashram. What is an ashram?
Ashram is simply a place where a monk resides, and that is what is called ashram, a place of just daily living. Instead of calling a home, we call it ashram.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting, yes. So you basically, you found the cave. And how long were you in the cave?
In and out, I might have been several years, but during that time of my intense practice, I think I was 2 years there.
Mm-hmm. So how did you find the cave?
It was somehow once I was traveling by a boat, in a river, and I saw a very, very scenic spot, and that time there was a monk living, and I was going to my college at university, and somehow I was charmed with the beauty of that place. So when after a few years I heard that that monk had passed away and I needed a place for my seclusion and practice, I ended up going and checking out that place. And there was a very little cave, so when I started living, I made it bigger, somehow got it dug deeper, and that is how I started living in that cave. It was very quiet, very scenic, and very, very beautiful.
It is
still there, and now I have got a couple of rooms also built there, just showing my love and gratitude to that place.
Wow. Mike, before I go on with some more questions, do you want to ask any questions?
Yeah. One of the questions that I had was, I just wondered just briefly if you had any advice that you could give us. You know, it's very interesting hearing about your lifetime and the different things you could experience. And, you know, I think there's time that a lot of us, especially in our country, wish that we could actually go and experience, you know, living in a cave for a while or living in solitude or actually just having the time to go within ourselves for a period of time to discover ourselves and connect with the divine and our higher selves. So I guess the question I'd like to pose to you is, what advice can you give to us for people that have very busy schedules, that are working a lot and raising families? What kind of advice can you give to them for them to be able to continue on with that busy lifestyle but still try to stay connected to their higher self and the divine through it? What kind of advice would you give to people like that, which I'm sure you encounter with people that you help?
Since you are interested in deep answer, let me tell you a very interesting story that should illustrate something about my own personal life process. When I went back to India after 5 years living in this country in 1985, I don't know, in some context I told some of my Indian friends that if I was going to be born again, I would rather be born a prostitute in America than a monk in India. Let me repeat, I told I would rather be a prostitute in America born rather than being born in India as a monk. The reason for saying that was that I found here people more honest. They could reveal their heart more gently, softly, clearly, without much fuss or much covering. And in India, in those days, it was not like that. We were cover up and hide and all that. But I am not going to say that I will repeat the same answer today. But in relation to your question, I would say I do not believe people are any more busy here and somewhere they are less busy. To me, everywhere, all wherever the humanity is, we all are very clever. We all rationalize. And human beings create their worst bondages through this kind of rationalization. I believe no one loves no one except oneself in the deepest sense. And when one loves oneself truthfully, and this word truthfully goes deeper and deeper and deeper, until one realizes that one's self is not this body-mind, but there is the real self, that is spirit, that lives through all of us. We keep on struggling and we keep on fooling ourselves. So in one word, my answer will be, we should all be truthful first and the last, and when we muster courage to be truthful as best as we could, we end up realizing our divine nature. It has nothing got to do with any culture, any religion, or any conditioning. That is my belief and faith, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I definitely agree with you, and I appreciate you answering that for me.
Yeah, this is a really good question. I love the answer. I love the way you said that, Swamiji. I'm just saying I would rather be a prostitute. So tell me about your experience in the cave.
My experience in the cave, when I was living, first, for several months, I would be very, very disciplined in my eating habits. I would be living on raisin and milk. And then after a few months, sometimes I will be eating too much, whatever I was eating. And then I caught myself, my God, sometimes I am so disciplined and sometimes I am so impulsive. So that was some kind of an eye-opener for me. And the other thing was that when villagers from nearby villages will visit me, I would feel very disgusted and annoyed that these villagers have no common sense. Here I am trying to devote all my time and energy in divine pursuit, and they come to distract me. So I thought they were very, very dumb and foolish. At the same time, I realized if nobody visited me for a week or so, I mentally found complaining that these people are so heartless, they don't come to see me, that I also, as a human being, need some comfort and consolation and encouragement. So I recognize my God both ways. I end up complaining whether they visit or they don't visit. And the third factor that really got me into deepest investigation of my life was that during those days I was very devotional about Lord Shiva, and I used to cry, literally cry, for Lord Shiva. And whole day I was doing nothing but meditating and prayers, and sometimes I will walk in the jungle. There was nothing else to do. But still in my sleep, in the night, still many times or often I will be chasing girls. So that gave me the greatest shock of my life, that my God, who am I here? When I am awake, I am crying for God. And when I am asleep, I am chasing girls. So who am I? What do I want? So this deep shock got me very much rather serious and more alert to examine who I am and what I want. And when I very sincerely pursued this subject, I started watching my mind much, much more minutely and seriously, I discovered that, oh my God, neither I care for Lord Shiva nor I care for girls. These thoughts or these desires come on their own for whatever reason, and they subside on their own for whatever reason, and I am the pure witness, the pure light, and I never do anything. And then spiritually I become established, and now that is what I teach, that all desires, whether they are most holy, most sublime, are most selfish and most ugly. We are not creator of our desires. It is the illusion that because of our lack of observation and awareness, we believe we create our desires. And the second part that is a little bit more difficult to really examine and to be convinced of, that all desires, when they arise, we do not decide anything about them, whether we will fulfill them or we will reject them. All these decisions are made for us according to our own conditioning. And that conditioning we all have in our so-called memory bank, where all our impressions are stored. So no matter whomever we consider holy or unholy, they are just acting and reacting according to those stored up impressions. So when one realizes that neither one is responsible for desiring, nor even responsible what decisions are made regarding those desires, then in the end, body automatically acts whatever decision has been made. So one becomes utterly, utterly humble in the sense that one is never a doer. It only apparently feels like that, like I am speaking to you. But am I the speaker? It is in that sense I am not the speaker. Whatever inspiration your words create in my heart, automatically that reaction brings these memories and I end up communicating through my mouth. So this is, I very strongly tell my students and friends, one should not believe it, because by believing this kind of belief, one can be very easily misled and one can start fooling oneself regarding any bad habit that, oh, I am not doing it, whether I am stealing or whether I am murdering or raping, it is just happening. So this is very confusing. So in the beginning, so one should be the most truthful, responsible doer as best as one could be. And when one really becomes the most truthful, most disciplined and most conscientious doer, only then this high realization automatically dawns that we all are instruments and only God is living through all of us. So that was my life-transforming realization that I was blessed when I was living in my cave.
Thank you. Mike, do you have a question at this point?
Yeah, I do. And one other question I have is, do you feel that you distinctly work in two different modes? Do you feel that you are working from your higher self mode all the time, all day, or do you think there's times where you might feel that you're, I don't know if I want to say disconnected, but times that you're just kind of doing things automatically without thinking of it in a more spiritual sense, you know, like if you're just, you know, like washing dishes or doing laundry or just going for a walk, or do you really feel that you're really able to maintain that higher self connection all the time? And the reason I ask, it kind of goes in sync with my previous question, is, you know, there's just a lot of times in our busy lives where we kind of reserve that higher self communication for times when we can meditate and be quiet. But I've always been interested in trying to figure out how to keep that connection going more throughout the day. And I was wondering if you had ever experienced any frustrations in yourself where you felt that, hey, I should have been in my higher mind with this and I wasn't? Or have you gotten to the point over the years where you feel that you keep that higher mind connection all the time?
I would only say I hear your question, but I don't know if I will be able to satisfy you with my answer. But the answer is like this. It is no more dependent on so-called any remembrance. Like I continue to be a man, whether I remember I am a man while talking or interacting with someone, or I just keep on talking or doing whatever I might be doing, and I always in the background believe I am a man. Like I always breathe, whether I consciously breathe or I am not conscious of breathing consciously, but breathing continues. So this realization that dawns on a deeper level does not require any kind of effort. As long as we put any effort, physical or mental, then we are still operating from the plane of a doer. And if the realization has gone deeper and the element of doership has been totally dissolved, then whatever happens, whether it happens sometimes very sweetly, gently, kindly, or sometimes impulsively and with some kind of anger or some kind of impatience, it just you accept it. Like sometimes you are tired, sometimes you are sleepy, sometimes you are hungry. You do not judge yourself, or you do not feel proud of yourself for whatever you go through. So I would say, I don't know if I make sense, this kind of struggle is no more there in my life.
Okay. Well, thank you for your answer to that, and I appreciate that.
Mm. Yeah, I like that. So, Swamiji, tell me more about your experience. Well, hold on for 1 second. Let me just take a quick break. For everybody that's tuning in, you're listening to Spiritual Connections Radio. As you know, basically the third Tuesday every month from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard,
We have what's called the Men's Spiritual Radio Hour, where we bring on, it's a show about men and their spiritual journeys. And we have our guest on this evening with us. And if you want to find out more about Swamiji, about the show, being able to get to it in the archives, listen to it later, or any other shows, you can go to our website at spiritualconnectionsradio.com. So going back to my original question, Swamiji, tell me more about your oh, hold on. My computer is deciding to do something. Let me reset that. Tell me about your experience in the cave as it continued to unfold, and when did you decide, okay, it's time for me to leave the cave and move on?
When I become totally settled and convinced that what I just shared, that whatever I end up doing, it just ends up happening to me. I am never, ever cause of doing anything. When it became crystallized in my consciousness, then I came back to my teacher. I shared my experience with him and then with others. And then still, I tell you, I still do my yoga. I still go for my yoga walks and meditations and all that. But it is like it happens sometimes in a natural way. And so that is how life has been going on for several years. So again, ask your question. Perhaps I am not getting your question in a very pointed way.
Yeah, sounds good to me. So after you left the cave, what was next for you in your life?
Oh, after that, I think for a couple of years, I might have traveled in India or might have been with my teacher, because when I came to this country, I was 35. Now I am 70, so I have spent so many years in this country. So I have been going back and forth. But still, I think now in a more practical way, I have lived a more active life in America than I could say I have lived in India.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, just going back to one of the lessons, because, you know, normally I would say, well, what is the biggest lesson you learned in the cave? And I think the answer to that is realizing the truth of non-doing. Would that be
right,
correct?
And besides that, I would say since early childhood, I don't know how I was led to practice truthfulness. I was always very, very rather particular that one should be truthful, one should be truthful. So still, I always insist with all my friends that if you want to become my friends, make sure you are 100% truthful. And you should expect 100% truthfulness from me. Otherwise, we can be so acquaintances, but I cannot be happy with you in my relationship with you. So I would say I am very much fond of, or most, I emphasize most on truthfulness to get into the wisdom of non-doing.
Mm-hmm. And I know you kind of covered this earlier when you were talking about your experience in the cave, but I think it's worth repeating. Explain to us what it means for the truth of non-doing.
Truth of non-doing is like realizing God's grace. And God's grace in the sense that the whole experience or the whole world becomes like a unfolding kaleidoscope, and that kaleidoscope is unfolding through God's will. So not that sometimes because of our humanness we complain and we become annoyed or hurt or scared, but basically the flavor remains the same, like you go to a movie and you know it is for fun and celebration, though sometimes you may cry because of the context of the movie. So life becomes a divine kind of celebration and experience once we are exposed to the higher wisdom. And I very strongly believe that in all religions, it has nothing got to do with Hinduism. All the mystics in all religions all ways have inspired humanity, not because of so-called their teachings, but because of their real life. Because it is the real life when we see someone being fearless, really fearless, someone being detached, not being sucked into money and power and any kind of superfluous fame and any recognition. And at the same time, someone being very kind in a very sincere way and someone being so playful and childlike, those things automatically charm our heart, because all human beings ultimately want to be happy, ultimately want to experience divine grace and peace and ease. So that is what I would say, that to whatever extent I am capable of living my life that way, or even if I am not capable to the extent I would like to be, I try my best, and I pray to God that my life becomes more and more totally, totally submerged in that kind of divine flow of ease, grace, cheerfulness, compassion, and fearlessness.
I think one of the interesting stories that's been happening to me as I've been experiencing my spiritual journey, I had actually started as a number of years working in the corporate world and spending most of my time working in technology and advancing my career. And I think the lesson that has been unfolding for me lately as I've been getting more involved in the spirituality aspects of myself is that for most of my life, I was always doing, I was always creating and pushing and making things happen and really just kind of being in what I call the male energy, which is one of just process and doing and almost being on push as into create and stuff like that. I think the lesson for me lately has been learning to go to the other aspect of myself, of just basically allowing life to be, to surrender. We use that word surrender, as in to surrender and allow things to be created and to kind of come into my life instead of me trying to make it all happen. I think with someone who has been trying to push and create things for so many years of his life, the hardest part about surrendering, I think, is trusting that God or the universe and everything's got it all covered and that I don't have to be always doing something.
I think it is not hard at this stage of your life. It is always hard. And in my understanding, that is the most vital and critical test for any spiritual seeker in any tradition. Like when I was growing up, I remember I used to be very much scared of ghosts. And then one day I decided, would I like to live a long life under the fear of ghosts? Or even if I drop dead one day in some haunted place, I would like to be free of the fear of ghosts. And I decided literally to spend one night under a haunted tree. And I was scared in the middle of the night, but somehow in the end, I survived, and since that night, I have never been exposed to that fear of ghosts. So other thing, what I am reminded through your words, I was exposed to a beautiful teaching of Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Somewhere he shares that those who exclusively seek me, those who exclusively care for me, to realize my grace, I naturally care for their survival, for their basic needs. So this always gave me the greatest comfort and solace, that unless I am literally starving and literally in utmost discomfort and pain, I must pursue exclusively God's grace. And I find it very, very difficult even today, to not only here in America and in India, too, everybody wants to make sure whether my bank balance is enough or not, whether I will get my milk and vegetables and clothes and all that. To me, that is what takes away from our real faith in God, from a very, very sincere, earnest point of view.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, definitely a great examples and everything. And I guess what would be the one or two things that I would want to embrace as I go through this journey of trust and surrender?
I did not get your question. I would say practically that whenever you can afford to devote a week or a couple of days here and there in unknown places, go without making plans and without caring or without carrying money and see how automatically, I don't know, let me share one story. Once I was driving from California to New York and somebody honked behind my car. And when I saw towards that car, the person was indicating towards my tires. And then I realized my car was wobbling because it had flat tires. And then when I took the next exit, that person also followed me. And when I got out of my car, the person who had indicated, he also got out of his car. And he asked me for my wrench and he changed the tire and he went to fix my tire and he got back and put the tire back. And when I wanted to take his address, he said, what address far, you know better. So he gave me a spiritual kind of a light that God's grace is present everywhere and God does not need this kind of telephone number. It is a divine connection. So what I mean to say that when we somehow expose ourselves with that kind of trust, automatically somehow divine help comes and we become more and more settled in our faith in God.
Mm. So it's almost like what they say, and that is the greatest way to approach your greatest fear is to basically embrace it. So what you were saying is that some of the examples would be for me to simply go and see what happens if I don't have
Absolutely.
Any money and just
Absolutely.
Basically
and
put myself in that situation.
And you will find you are always provided. So far in my entire life, I have been as much loved or even more loved in this country than perhaps I would have been loved and adored in India. So to me, humanity is one, it is the same God, same drama unfolds everywhere. We give different names and all that because that is how we are conditioned in our head. Otherwise, it is all divine flow everywhere, whether we die here or anywhere else.
Mm. Well, thank you for that guidance. That's actually really incredible, and it validates a lot of what I kind of had as a knowing inside myself, but it was great to see it expressed.
Thank you for giving me this sweet opportunity. You are a very good-hearted person, so I admire your this kind of interest and this kind of service for humanity. May God give you this kind of power and zeal to be always serviceable to fellow beings.
Mm. Hey, Mike, what do you have as far as a closing question as we're kind of heading into the very end of the show already?
One of the questions I had was what are your comments on, as I do healing music myself, I rely a lot on sound and vibration when I'm creating a meditative space. So in some of the meditation practices that you do and you've experienced, what can you tell me about how important the sound and vibration are around you? Because I know there are instances where it's good to do meditation in quiet. But if you're a person like I am where you're not able to meditate in quiet as easy as you are with some kind of soft music or so forth, have you ever meditated to any kind of soft music, or do you prefer to do it by just using your own music from your voice, such as doing ohms and so on and so forth?
No, I am very much for music, and in fact, I recently got a tape of Oming, and since you reminded me, I will expose myself to that beautiful sound vibration of Om. And whatever a person could click with, sound has got a very, very sweet divine power to comfort our mind and to make our mind focused and to get our mind transcendental. So to me, it is one of the most rather recognized paths in India. Since we don't have much time. Otherwise, it is also as valid to let the mind totally merge in some sound, or like a humming sound. People create this kind of humming sound and meditate on that sound, and then they realize the divine kind of grace through that sound of humming or oming. So I very much appreciate that you are into music and you help fellow beings with your sound vibrations, sir.
Oh, thank you. Well, we're actually at the end of the show already, and with that, I'd like to just turn to Swamiji for a moment and say, in closing, what is the biggest lesson you'd like to give to our audience as far as, you know, something they should pay attention to in life?
My biggest request and advice will be have trust in divine providence and God, and be more and more humble and thankful whatever you have been provided for, and make the best use of it as kindly and truthfully as you could. Make the best use of whatever you have been provided with most truthfully and most humbly and kindly, and you are bound to be blessed with the ultimate grace that a human being is supposed to enjoy in life.
Thank you. It's a great honor to have you on, Swamiji. We really appreciate you taking the time to do this. As we had said in the beginning of the show, it's amazing how quickly an hour goes. And we could probably talk to you for another 2 or 3 hours easily with all the wisdom and everything. For anybody who's listening, make sure to go to spiritualconnectionsradio.com to get the replay for the show. You can also get the link for Facebook for Swamiji. As always, it's a great honor to have you on. And thank you, Mike, as always, for co-hosting the show. And I want to just say good night to everybody. And with that, we'll end with, as Swamiji would say, Om.
Life is but a dream.